accession number 20938, Reel 3.
Major Kiley, Reel 3.
Yes, all the time I was in that position on the side of the hill, Sergeant Kenny was lying behind me, a few yards behind, down the hill. He could not get up. He tried, and a number of the stretcher bearers tried to get up to get me back, but it seemed to be impossible. Every time somebody showed themselves there, there was a burst of fire straight over me, and we were all very unpleasant. We lost, I think I'm right to say, probably one or two stretcher bearers in their efforts to get me back. And all this time this was going on, Kelly was gradually getting up closer and closer and closer. He crawled up behind me, and after, probably an hour or more, I felt him grab my equipment and slowly pulled me back. And I think there were one or two shots at the time. Unfortunately, they did not register at all. Kelly didn't get touched. And he got me back, and I was then loaded onto an ambulance jeep and taken down to the field dressing station and so on. And I always said that if it hadn't been for Kelly, I'm pretty certain I wouldn't be sitting here now. He stayed with me all the time and fed me with morphia as well, which also was a great help. And I had all great admiration for that chap. He was a great character. But eventually I was moved down to a dressing station in brigade headquarters, where I was dressed and cleaned up, because I was in a pretty filthy mess. And I was then flown from there to the main hospital at Camilla. And that's where I said I stayed in Camilla. My leg was set at the brigade area originally, to not set, but anyway, fitted together as best they could, and fitted with a caliper so that it didn't wander about. And I was then flown out to Camilla. When I arrived at Camilla, they had me in there, and that is when I came face to face with a fully qualified orthopedic surgeon, and he set my leg and set it firmly and put me into a caliper. In fact, I was into a plaster, really, from my neck down to my toes. The right leg was the left leg was free. It came down to there, the body stuff, and then the other leg was right down to the toe plaster. It was then, whilst I was in the hospital, the young orthopaedic surgeon, because he was quite a young man, in fact he was a young man, probably reasonably newly qualified, and but he was very capable, very clever, and he came to me one day and said, we should be sending you back to Central India, to Pune, prior to being shipped on a hospital ship back to England. And he said, I would like to keep you here if you're prepared to stay, because we've got your leg in such a position that I think it's going to be respond extremely well. I said, I'm your responsibility now. If you say I should stay, I most certainly will stay. I want to be able to walk properly, not to limp around the place. And so I stayed in Camilla, which was a a field hospital with open sides to it. It was native huts, in other words, or native thing, which was under mosquito nets at night, and but they're all the sides are open. And so there I stayed. He said, I'd like you to stay here, if you don't mind, for 3 or 4 months. So I stayed. It wasn't very comfortable, it was a bit hot and it was a bit sticky. Camilla is also the headquarters of 14th Army. And that is when General William Sloan came around and recognised me as one of the young officers who had helped in his early days when he was commanding a brigade in Jhansi. And anyway, it was we were extremely well looked after. And then when it was considered that I had reached a certain point in my healing, I was shipped to Pune, a couple of weeks or so in Pune, and from Pune on to a hospital ship. And the hospital ship then, and the hospital ships were pretty well the only ships that went through the canal. So,
what were conditions like in the hospital ship?
Well, crowded a bit, but I mean, they were very good considering everything. I mean, I was an extremely good nurse. She was a senior nurse in the Queen Alexandra's nursing service. And I was allowed to get out of my bed when it was not too rough. And I used to go up and usually join one of the lady doctors in her cabin. She was REMC. And she and one or two other doctors and people like myself, you know, we somehow or other used to be able to get hold of a bottle of whiskey or something and devour that during the course of the evening, which made the evening comparatively. We had a lot of fun, really. And came back to Avonmouth near Bristol, where we were disembarked into a hospital train in the middle of the night. I had made a comment to one of my friends that the first girl I meet in England, I'm going to give her a really good kiss. And we arrived in Avonmouth at night, and I was moved off into, as most of us were, into a hospital train, which eventually went to Bradford Royal Infirmary in Yorkshire. Anyway, I was carried on to this hospital ship, and a girl in the ambulance was there. I couldn't see her because it was night. And I put my arms around her and gave her a large kiss. And she was really rather taken aback. And when the next day appeared, I suppose she must have been, it looked very ancient to me, but I don't suppose she was much more than 45. But anyway, she wasn't a young, budding beauty. It was all rather, it all taken in the best of spirit. They will move me up to Bradford Royal Infirmary, where in Bradford were marvellous. The business people, the Yorkshire firms, used to send their cars and drivers around to the hospital to collect people like myself, take them round, and you find yourself being introduced to various households of people. They were terribly hospitable. They were marvellous. And I This would be on my 24th of December, just about, and then I was being sent home from Brentford to my home, which was then in North Wales, in Conwy in North Wales. And I was moved down to the station by a nurse who accompanied me to the station. I arrived there. I'm in a caliper and two crutches at this stage, or two caliper shorts, not under the arms. And I was arrived in, they handed me over to the station master. And I sat down in the station, and nobody, I remember that it was Christmas Eve, nobody was allowed onto that train by the station master until I got onto it. And there were hundreds waiting to go to Lancashire and on to Wales and all over the place. But he was going to determine to get me down there. Anyway, I was eventually taken down by the nurse who came down with me and the station master into a compartment, one complete compartment, and that was for Major Kiley. And I sat down. And until I was on that train, on that particular car, nobody else had been allowed in at all.
Is this at Bradford Station?
This is at Bradford Station. And the station master said, right, you'll be all right now, sir. I said, I'm sorry, but what about all these people? There were hundreds waiting to travel on there. I said, I can't sit in this compartment all to myself. He said, but it's yours. I said, well, look, for goodness sake, fill it up. He said, well, if you say so, I will. And he did. He filled it up. And I had a seat, and there were about another 8 or 9 who also had seats as a result, and plus standing room and sitting around all over, because we had a lot of people trying to get onto this train. And off we went to Lancashire, where I was met by my sister. We went to Preston, I think it was. Anyway, there he attitude completely changed. Yorkshire was one thing, Lancashire was another. Lancashire, you take your turn with anybody else. And there was no sort of, didn't matter whether you were on crutches or what, I admit, the difference was quite incredible. But, so my sister and I got, she met me, and person we got onto the Colwyn Bay train and were soon home. That was my first return for 5 years.
Why had you made this vow to kiss the first woman in England?
Lack of any, I suppose, the whole of the Burma, there were no white women at all, except odd nurses on the ship and so on and so forth. But it was just a young man's brag that he was he would enjoy a bit of female company, I suppose.
Did you make a full recovery?
Well, eventually I became engaged in 19. And that was generally December 1944 when I'd been relating. And in 1945, I became engaged. My wife, who was the same one we've met, she suddenly said, she was taking me up the Great Orme, but you know, London in that era, up the Great Orme. And she said, you don't need these sticks. Threw it away. So I threw one away and fell over. But that didn't make any difference. Just held me up and we went on. And I went blend on one stick for a considerable time after that. But I became, you asked whether I was, and I made a complete recovery. Complete. I got back after a few months in a convalescent depot in Richmond Park. After all this, I reported back for duty, and I was back in normal duties right away until I retired eventually, some 30 years later, 20 years later.
Did you go into action again?
No.
How do you feel now about having served with the Northamptonshires in Burma?
Oh, I'd do it again. It was a wonderful experience, quite honestly. The British soldier is a wonderful chap, you know. He really is. I mean, he's a wonderful chap to serve with. And I was never, ever let down by any British soldier getting... I had the odd one throw a bit of a tantrum because he was frightened pure. One came to mind where one young chap was very sad, really. He was absolutely crying his eyes out. And I took him aside and we chatted him and said, "Now look, this is the job we've all got to do, I'm afraid." And he apologised to me, and he said he was scared solid. And I said, "Well, so I think one can honestly say we all are." And anyway, he turned up, and the offer was he was killed the next day.
That was
in Burma, and in the Tidham area, really.
What was happening at the time to make him so frightened?
Oh, Japanese attacks. Gun attacks, artillery, and so on. He was generally scared. But also talking to, and he was. And got rid of his fear. And unfortunately, it so often happens, you know, you get somebody and you settle them down, and something happens, and invariably they're killed in something. You know, something was just one of those things that seems to happen.
How was he killed?
He was killed, if I remember rightly, by artillery fire and shrapnel or something.
Where did he come from?
Somewhere in the Midlands, I would say Leicester or the Birmingham area. But we got... recruits from all around that era. They weren't all just from Northamptonshire.
What was the worst thing about the Burma campaign?
I suppose the worst thing about the Burma campaign was deprivation, you know, deprivation of... such ghastly food one has and all that sort of thing. Oh, jolly pleased to have it, mark you. Tins of bully beef and solid biscuits and things and going on these things for days. But eventually the cooks got through with a decent, what they call, all-in stew when everything went into the stew pot. One got so hungry, and he said, "You're very, very prepared to eat anything."
Did your health suffer from the diet?
Nope. I was one of the very few people who was extremely lucky, extremely fortunate. I don't know, I can't tell you why it should be that I was, and there are so many others, but the numbers that went down with dysentery and malaria and everything else, touch wood. I never had dysentery or malaria in the 5 years that I was out there. Never once.
What were you awarded the Military Cross for?
I think one might say for doing one or two somewhat stupid things, but which were considered by one's superiors that was... something a bit on the bravery side. I don't know that it was, really. But anyway, that's really what it was. It was I went out on patrol with, I took a young officer out with me, and we went out to locate a Japanese prisoner. This was on the Silchar track, up on the top. And Geoffrey Hetherington was the young man who's died since. He came with me, and we located the Japanese position. In fact, we were sitting there listening to them. They were shouting and laughing away and so on. And we worked out how far, how near we could get to this position in order to make a grenade attack. Because we had these grenade cups which went on top of the rifle, and we put the grenade down, put in a cartridge, and then these things went off through the air. Very nasty they were too. And so having located the Japanese in this position, we went back, we got our patrol of about 10 Japs, complete with grenades, and went back again. And still they were there laughing and joking. And having watched them for about 10 minutes, we decided this had gone on long enough, and we set fire, set off our grenades and so on, and it was... It was one of the few occasions in the whole war where I saw the effects of those grenades absolutely accurate, right in the middle of them in the guard area.
Why didn't they have any guards out? Why weren't they taking more precaution?
Typical Japanese, really. They were very casual at times. This track was the Silchar track, which went through to India, which really was a native track. You could probably get a bullet cart or something like that. You could probably get a jeep along it if necessary. But it was... the Japanese... they were... funny people. If they wanted to, they could lie up for hours and create havoc, but generally speaking, if they gave themselves away, it didn't seem to worry them unduly. Death didn't worry them, you know. Not at all.
So after you'd found the grenades into them, did you then withdraw?
Or? Yeah, we then withdrew. No, we'd done our job. We'd silenced that particular spot. And we withdrew to our positions.
What other occasions were you awarded the Military Cross for? Can you remember?
No, it was only the... there were various things like that that all built up in the... the ultimate award. So much depends on what the commanding officer writes in his citation, which has then got to go forward to brigade headquarters, and the brigade commander can either agree it or not agree it, as the case may be. And that's what happened.